Thank you for inviting me to speak here today. I'm honoured to be speaking alongside experts in the legal services sector. Over the next sort of 10 minutes or so, I'll highlight the key findings from our 2016 study into the supply of legal services, and in particular outline the transparency recommendations we've made to make the legal service sector work better, or so we hope. First, just a bit of context. The Competition and Markets Authority was created in April 2014 from the Office of Fair Trading and the Competition Commission. We aim to make markets work well for consumers, business and the economy by promoting competition and protecting consumers across the UK economy. We investigate a range of things, including mergers, markets and potential breaches of competition law, enforce consumer protection legislation and conduct regulatory appeals. On the market side, we've looked at a broad range of issues and sectors, including, for example, the role of on-rail competition in the rail sector and our two major market investigations into energy and retail banking. Most recently, we launched new market studies into two quite different areas, care homes for the elderly and digital comparison tools. So why did we decide to look at legal services? What made us think that the legal services markets for individuals and small businesses in England and Wales could work better? Well, there are a range of reasons, notably the fact that there have been long-standing and well-publicised concerns about the affordability of and the access to legal services, and the fact that a high proportion of consumers do not appear to be seeking to purchase legal services when they have legal needs. There were also concerns about regulation dampening competition. And of course, the sector is very significant in terms of size and its importance in people's lives. For many years, the CMA's predecessor bodies have had an interest in legal and professional services. Most notably, the Office of Fair Trading carried out a review of professional services in 2001, which led to the Clementi Review and the Legal Services Act 2007. Whilst, of course, the CMA is not a technical expert in the legal services area, we brought together current thinking from a range of stakeholders and used our experience from across the economy to put forward recommendations about how the sector might work better. Before I discuss our transparency recommendations, I'll briefly outline what we looked at and set out our high-level findings. So this slide shows that we examined three issues. The first one was whether consumers are making informed purchases, which in turn drive competition. The second is whether consumers are adequately protected through existing regulations and redress mechanisms. And the third is about the impact of regulation on competition. That is, whether there are any unnecessary restrictions or distortions as a result of regulation. So what were our findings? Well, first of all, we found that competition between legal service providers for individuals and small businesses is not working as well as it should be. There's a lack of information on price, quality, and service to enable consumers to make informed purchasing decisions that drive competition. The LSB's research found that only 17% of firms publish any form of price information online. Consumers rely to a large extent on recommendations, which makes a lot of sense in a sector where there's a strong information asymmetry and quality is inherently difficult to observe. But it's unlikely to drive competition and may make it more difficult for new providers to enter and compete effectively. This lack of transparency might explain why the LSB found substantial price dispersion for similar products, with the result that some consumers are likely to be paying more than they need to. The slide, for example, shows the prices quoted by providers for various divorce scenarios. Even if we just consider the difference between the lower and upper quartiles, the price for a complex divorce scenario, which is the fifth one along on the slide, varied from around £1,260 to £3,000, and much more if you take the full range of prices that were quoted. It might also explain why many consumers believe that they cannot afford legal advice, even when they would benefit from it. We also found that digital comparison tools are relatively uncommon in legal services, and that innovation in the sector was sluggish. In addition, we found there was a need for better information to help consumers identify if they have a legal need, how to purchase legal services, and the different provider options in the market so that consumers can actively engage. Our second theme was whether information failures result in consumer protection issues that are not being adequately addressed through existing regulations or redress mechanisms. Legal service providers are subject to varying degrees of regulation and consequently offer different levels of consumer protection. we found that the majority of consumers were unaware of the regulatory status of their provider and the implications of using providers who are not regulated under the Legal Services Act. Based on a limited evidence base, we did not find that consumers were more likely to experience quality issues if they purchased legal services from unauthorised providers. We did, however, have concerns that consumers who use unauthorised providers don't benefit from the redress mechanisms that are available to customers of authorised providers, such as the free complaints handling service offered by the Legal Ombudsman. Our third theme was whether regulation and the regulatory framework go beyond what is necessary to protect consumers and, in fact, weaken or distort competition. We found evidence that some regulations may be disproportionate to the consumer benefits they seek to achieve, which may in turn lead to higher prices for consumers. Although this does not appear to represent a major barrier to entry for new providers, it may limit innovation, and we therefore welcome steps already being taken by regulators to reduce the regulatory burden of the providers that they regulate. We did, however, identify that the current regulatory structure is not fully aligned with risk. For example, the provision of certain reserved legal activities leads to a high degree of regulation, but does not necessarily reflect the associated risks to consumers, while all other legal activities can be provided by persons who are not subject to such regulation and the quality standards that they impose. In practice, few consumers currently use unauthorised providers, but this may change over time and could lead to consumer detriment to which the current regulatory framework cannot effectively respond. The existing framework may therefore not be sustainable in the long run. Although our focus has primarily been on the impact of regulation on competition, we note the complexity of the current institutional structures, with 9 arm's-length regulators overseen by the Legal Services Board. Furthermore, concerns have been expressed around the independence of the regulators from the professions that they regulate. That's why we believe that a key principle for any future reform of the regulatory framework is that regulators should be fully independent from government and from the providers that they represent. A reduction in the number of regulators may also be appropriate in the future, in line with many other regulatory regimes, to provide greater consistency and efficiency. However, the appropriate structure should ultimately depend on the preferred regulatory approach, rather than be revised in isolation. So I'll now talk briefly about our recommendations based on those findings, which these address, focusing in particular on the recommendations that we made in relation to transparency. I referred earlier to our experience in other markets. As consumers, we expect to be able to search around for deals, exercise choice, and easily find feedback on providers. This isn't just limited to instances when we're buying common goods or services, such as flights or car insurance, but it extends to key decisions, such as searching for the right childcare provider or researching hospital consultants for an upcoming medical procedure. These developments have brought real benefits to consumers, including lower costs, greater choice, and more innovation. We want consumers to realise the same benefits when they buy legal services, particularly given the importance of access to affordable and good quality legal services at critical points in people's lives. To achieve this, we believe that consumers need to have greater access to information on the price, quality, and service that they can expect. We've therefore recommended that regulators introduce new minimum standards on the information that lawyers provide to their customers on websites and in person. Providers will, for the first time, have to provide consumers with clear information on the price and service they can expect, importantly, before they choose their provider. This could include, for example, the pricing model used, fixed fees, hourly rates, or scenario-based pricing, indicative fees or rates, details of the service to be provided, staff qualifications, and experience and details of redress. We're working closely with the regulators as they define and codify these new standards. We've also seen that recommendations play an important role in the legal services sector and see a greater role for aggregated reviews and recommendations, for example, through independent feedback platforms. We've therefore recommended that regulators encourage providers to engage with quality signals, such as online reviews, and provide guidance on how best to do so. Another important area is the availability of data. We've recommended that regulators make more data available through open data licensing in machine-readable formats to facilitate the development of digital comparison tools. By making this information freely and easily accessible in one place, Consumers will be more easily able to choose a legal service provider and see regulatory information, which might, for example, include complaints data, alongside information on price, service, and quality. In addition, to help empower consumers by giving them the information they need to navigate the sector and identify when they have legal needs, we have recommended that the regulators overhaul the existing Legal Choices website. The redevelopment should include input from consumer and business groups with a clear focus on the needs of consumers. To make sure that customers or consumers access Legal Choices at the right time, we've also recommended that the site is actively promoted, including by regulators and legal service providers. In addition to our transparency remedies, we've made recommendations relating to consumer protection and to regulation. To address the redress gap we identified, we've recommended to the Ministry of Justice that it reviews whether to extend redress mechanisms to cover consumers using unauthorised providers. For example, this could be pursued through extending access to legal ombudsmen or through alternative arrangements using alternative dispute resolution or self-regulation. We also recommended to the Ministry of Justice that it should coordinate a programme with other bodies in the sector to adapt existing data sources to capture information relating to unauthorised providers, including complaints, thus allowing better comparisons in future. Finally, to address the issues we identified with regards to the existing regulatory framework, we've recommended a review of the regulatory framework in the longer term. We've made a number of short-term recommendations in this area. First, that the Ministry of Justice should carry out its planned review of the independence of regulators. Second, that regulators should continue to take action to reduce regulatory costs where not reflective of consumer protection risks. And third, we've indicated support for the SRA's proposals to remove regulatory restrictions in order to allow solicitors to practice in unauthorised firms. We believe that these measures taken together will deliver a necessary step change in transparency, competition and consumer engagement and regulatory changes in the legal services sector. Our recommendations on improving information and transparency are directed at regulators, with the LSB providing oversight and public reporting on the progress made by regulators. We've established a programme board which will coordinate the implementation work programme of the regulators for increasing transparency in the sector and also, where possible, promote consistency of approach. I'm pleased to say we had a very constructive first meeting of that programme board this morning. We recognise it's going to be challenging to achieve change for individuals and small businesses in the legal services sector, although we're encouraged by the positive commitments made by many of the regulators. Access to better information on price and service is a necessary first step to increasing competition in the sector, but it may not be sufficient to drive consumer engagement up to the levels required to bring the full benefits of competition. We are committed to supporting the implementation of our recommendations over 2017, and at the end of 3 years, we'll assess the progress made in increasing competition in the legal services sector, building on the Legal Services Board and the Consumer Panel's ongoing programmes of research and monitoring, and we'll consider whether any further action by the CMA is necessary. Thank you for the opportunity to present tonight, and I look forward to the rest of the presentations and discussion. Thank you.
Great. So, good evening, everybody. I thought I would just start by, I suppose, praising the CMA for what I think is a very high quality, maybe dependably high quality piece of work. When I was invited to participate this evening, I wondered what team I was supposed to be on. Was I representing the sort of competition advocacy side, or was I representative of my department and my own profession with our own vested interests at stake here? Mercifully, the report itself, I think, isn't a particularly partisan piece, and so it's a very measured and nuanced account of the benefits of competition, but also the limitations at multiple stages of competition in these sorts of markets, and I feel that I can hopefully be suitably measured in my remarks, which pick up on maybe more academic aspects of the report. I think this middle way probably works quite well in view of the sort of the level of competition that already exists in legal markets in England and Wales. We don't have the market fundamentalism that you see in some jurisdictions. Anyone who's ever taken a subway in New York knows the lurid ads you get for every sort of legal service on the planet, versus the much more controlled, highly regulated, uncompetitive professions that you see in some continental European member states. There are indeed entire swathes of the European free movement rules which owe their jurisprudence entirely to the Italian legal profession, for instance. So I think the level of competition that exists at present is pretty, you know, we have a liberalised market, we've had regulatory reform, and the question is to what extent would further competition be a good thing? Or maybe to what extent might we actually realise the benefits of the existing level of competition in these markets? Because we see quite an interesting conundrum in the legal services report. We have a market which in theory doesn't have any problems on the supply side. I googled some lawyer jokes before I came here, and certainly popular culture does not think we have a lack of lawyers out there, but the report itself confirms that. These are unconcentrated markets. There are lots of ostensible competitors existing in these markets. There are low barriers to entry and to exit, or comparatively low barriers. So there's no problem with supply, which would suggest that the consumer should be reaping the benefits. The consumer should be sovereign in these markets. Yet consumers are not acting in a competitive manner and thus are not enjoying the benefits that competition can bring. And I think the report is very nuanced and is very is illuminating in sort of setting out this problem and trying to craft remedies that might help the consumer to engage with the market in order to enjoy the benefits of competition and liberalisation. In the remarks that follow, so I'm going to look at three aspects of the report. I'm going to talk about, because I do have my own vested interests here, I'm going to talk a little bit about maybe the implications for education. I'm going to talk a little bit about innovation, and then I'm going to focus on the notion of consumer engagement, which I think is a really interesting aspect coming out of the report, and you can draw parallels to other work that the CMA has done recently. So first, education. What I thought, and so as somebody who works in the field of legal education, one of the interesting aspects that struck me, particularly reading about how we don't seem to have a problem with the supply side, was the implications for the other reforms that are potentially ongoing in this area. And I'm thinking particularly the proposals to reform or change entry routes for solicitor qualifications in the UK. There is a proposal to decouple the qualifying law degree from the solicitor training a programme, introduced something called the SQE, which is supposed to be a bit more like the bar exam or the legal training in some continental European member states. This report doesn't provide an argument against doing so, but it doesn't suggest that we have a consumer problem resulting from a lack of supply. So to the extent that we're going to liberalise entry into the solicitor profession, there might be many reasons for doing that, increasing the quality of the solicitors that come online, the education they get, maybe just making it easier to become a solicitor because we think you shouldn't be held back by heritage or circumstances beyond your control. But certainly there doesn't seem to be evidence that if we allow greater levels of entry into the solicitor profession, if we make it easier, that consumers are going to reap any particular benefit from that. The second, education aspect that I thought was interesting was just the portrait of the legal profession you see in this particular report, which is so different from what we teach our students at undergrad and at postgrad level of what law is. This is law as a business. It's about how do we get the cheapest will and the cheapest conveyancing transactions, whereas we talk about the rule of law and accountability and democracy and legitimacy and all these ideas. And it links to the perennial question of what should we teach in an academic undergraduate law degree? Are we teaching the wrong stuff? Should we be more business oriented? I don't think this report changes the current view that practice and theory can be different things, but at least it points again to the fact that the reality, once you leave your ivory tower academy, is going to be very different legal business. So second, innovation. This was a particular aspect of the report that really struck me, because of course in competition policy in 2017, it's all about innovation. It's not just about protecting today's consumer, but it's about innovating so that tomorrow's consumer gets a better deal too. One of the findings of the report is that the absence of competition, the absence of competitive pressures that consumers place on service providers, is that service providers don't have any incentives to innovate. They are busy enjoying their monopoly reward of a quiet life. And the report suggests that there might be innovation in terms of online service delivery, unbundling of services, greater use of technology are listed as potential avenues for innovation. This was an aspect of the report that I thought would have been interesting to develop further. I think many of us would inherently see the law as a conservative profession, and of course there are very serious limits to innovation in terms of what the law actually demands. There's only so many bells and whistles you can add to a will or a conveyancing transaction before it stops being legally valid. I thought it would have been quite interesting to hear a little bit more or to think a little bit more about what innovation in this market might actually look like. The third, and I suppose the most important consideration I want to talk about, is this notion of consumer engagement as being the core, both the core, the lack of engagement being the core of the problem, activating consumers being the core of the remedy. The portrait of consumers you get in the report, they're almost an anti-hero in the report. You just think, why won't they just help themselves? They're so irrational. They refuse to see that their problems might have a legal disposition. When they realise they might need legal services, they refuse to shop around. They ask people who are wildly unqualified to give them advice, and then they act on that advice. They put undue emphasis on labels like solicitor and barrister, which they think are a guarantee of quality. They specifically dislike all the sorts of things that a service provider, a commercial operator, might use to distinguish themselves. So, branding. Consumers inherently dislike branded solicitors. They dislike advertising. They think it's exploitative. They seem to think it's a bit tacky, basically. So consumers refuse to engage with all those market forces which are designed to help them activate the power they have as a consumer to get a better deal. And this notion that, I suppose, consumer engagement is both the problem but also potentially the solution struck me as very interesting. And there are, I think, sort of important parallels to draw between another recent piece of work done by the CMA, which you may not have seen because it was published on the rather inauspicious date of the 24th of June last year, which is the report into the energy inquiry, where the CMA has done a lot of work trying to figure out what's wrong with energy markets in the UK. And the one source of the problem, they say again, as in legal services markets, is an absence of consumer engagement. It is possible for consumers, there is competition out there to be had, but market participants are failing to activate those competition potential. And the solution in both the energy market and the legal services market is to try and increase consumer participation by things like transparency, information provision, actively requiring suppliers to change their market offerings so as to make it easier for consumers to get a better deal. Interestingly, in the energy market, this is something that has been tried for many years. It's been one of the cornerstones of energy market regulation in the UK for many years. The Energy Market Inquiry admits it hasn't worked very well, but says we've learned from past experiences and we think we can improve on what's gone before. I guess that maybe creates the question when it comes to legal services of whether there's going to be a period of learning experience as to how we get the consumer engagement right. But I thought, in addition to sort of the parallels, there's also an interesting contrast between the two groups of consumers, or the two images of the disengaged consumers we see in these different markets. in energy markets, we've got both energy and legal services. I think we've got values at stake that go beyond purely just competition. Access to justice, of course, in legal services markets, but things like combating energy poverty in energy markets, which have a non-economic dimension to them. But it actually seems like energy markets are, it might be easier to get consumers to engage. These are not one-shot transactions as they often are in legal services markets. You try not to get divorced on a regular basis. You've also got the sort of, it's easy to judge quality in many ways, or much easier to judge quality in energy markets than it is in a legal services market. You buy a conveyancing transaction, you might not find out until many years in the future that something went wrong with that transaction, that something was improperly conveyed. Whereas you know pretty quickly if your lights don't work or if your heating doesn't work. So it's easier to judge quality, yet it's still difficult to get consumers to engage in those markets. So I think the nature of the product at issue when it comes to legal services poses additional barriers to the notion of consumer engagement. The legal services, the report talks about unmet demand as well in a very maybe undifferentiated sense. And I'm sure there is unmet demand, but I suppose the question I had was, should all unmet demand be as legitimate as each other? I think most people in the room would have more sympathy for example, a couple whose marriage ended sort of in fact many years ago but continues in law because they can't afford a divorce, rather than somebody who's tripped over on a paving stone and wants to take Westminster Council to the cleaners but can't afford the personal injury lawyer to do so. So I wonder whether maybe looking into the notion of unmet demand and where it comes from might have been an interesting question, which again links to the Energy Market Report, because it was a much greater undertaking. It was a proper market investigation reference case. But they looked very closely at who the disengaged consumer is. And they found out, actually, it tends to be the vulnerable consumers. Vulnerable consumers have most to gain from engaging in the market process, but they are least likely to do so. And the outcome in the remedy in the energy example was to actually treat them, I suppose, in a special category and, in fact, impose price regulation for very vulnerable consumers in energy markets. I was thinking about what the equivalent might be for the vulnerable consumer in legal services markets, and of course I think the answer is civil legal aid, which, as I've just been told about 2 minutes, I'm actually going to end here because I don't think you can cover the problems with civil legal aid in the UK in 2017 in 2 minutes. But it again brings us back to, I suppose, the non-market dimensions of the legal services market. We're doing more than just maximising consumer efficiency, producer efficiency here.
Well done. Me next, okay. I feel here I am, Robert Bournes, President of the Law Society of England and Wales. I am a solicitor in practice, and therefore, and I've been involved with the Law Society since 2011 and president since last July. I feel that I am perhaps something approaching the filling in the sandwich between the academics and then moving through to the operationally independent arm of the Law Society, the Solicitors Regulation Authority. So it's a great pleasure to be here this evening as a practitioner and president of the Law Society, and I thank the LSE for providing this opportunity to talk about the CMA's work. Neve has thrown out such a lot that I'd love to comment on, but I think we have time this evening. I have to say that the law as a conservative profession, yes, characterised, but very often spoken about by pundits out there as being far too liberal to be comfortable to live with, and taking cases on behalf of the weak, the vulnerable, the unpopular, and generally challenging other aspects of the regime in this country. Anyway, the report we're talking about considers the operation of and competition within the legal services market, but only part of the overall market, that part associated with individuals and SMEs. on the CMA's own figures, that is a market worth about £11 billion a year, which of course represents millions of engagements between people in need and practitioners. The overall market, for your information, is about £25 billion, generating about £3.6 billion worth of export earnings. The sector, the solicitor's profession, employs and trains about 370,000 people through nearly 10,000 businesses. So it's a rather more fractured market than perhaps the energy market that was referred to earlier, providing the infrastructure, I say, of provision right across England and Wales, and in the case of city firms, across the globe. Many of these 10,000 firms are themselves small businesses, part of their local communities, operating in a way that many larger organisations, perhaps the energy companies, the banks and others, cannot. What is termed law of England and Wales, the common law, has been and remains a fantastic global success, employed in about 40% of all transactions across the globe. A fantastically important contribution to the economy and the standing of UK PLC, and that should not be forgotten. It is a competitive market out there where other jurisdictions are keen to undermine the use of English and Welsh law, and this jurisdiction as the jurisdiction of choice. And here we sit next to the RCJ and not far from the Rolls Building. I say some people in my role as President of the Law Society have to worry about their successor. I have in the room my predecessor, who is now Chief Executive of the Council of Laws Societies in Australia, one of those jurisdictions, a common law jurisdiction, that is anxious to extend and take advantage of any argument it can. So, Jonathan, you're very welcome back, but move on again, please. So we cherish and promote this jurisdiction as we should the rule of law. And when Niamh therefore says, are we teaching the right thing? Are we paying attention to the right thing? We certainly are. The rule of law and the independence of the advisor from the interests of their client. Fundamental things that we need to keep in mind. But what I say is not a plea to ossify the market. The way we work has and will continue to change. Maybe not fast enough for some, but too fast for others. We will only succeed as practitioners, as we have only been able to succeed, where we provide value to our clients within their own definition and understanding of value. And that goes to some of the issues that are thrown out by the CMA. Having said that, I am grateful to the CMA for its recognition that consumers believe that the solicitor brand is a proxy for high quality and trustworthiness. This is an important part, trustworthiness, of being a solicitor. So is quality, so is independence. This assumption by consumers was endorsed by the Legal Services Board in its discussion document last autumn, speaking to the contribution to quality made by solicitors and barristers, quality in the home market and to the standing of the jurisdiction internationally. The CMA, in its interim report in July of last year, found that the market, although capable of improvement, was competitive, and it certainly feels like it when you're in it, and did not warrant full investigation. So we don't have market abuse in the way that sometimes CMA report. So we have, how do we improve the market? That's the issue. Unmet demand. And Niamh has certainly begged a number of questions so far as that is concerned. The CMA notes that the individuals and SMEs, the focus of this report, are not frequent purchasers of legal services. They will approach the market at a time of need, loss, injury, divorce, moving house, unemployment, in the case of a business, a dispute, potentially affecting cash flow, potentially its lifeline. These purchasers are therefore buying at a time of vulnerability. And the CMA recommends at paragraph 4.52 that consumers are often unable to judge the quality of legal advice until the matter is finalised, as Niamh said. Indeed, they may not even be able to make this assessment after the service has been provided. You don't know you haven't got a right of way until somebody challenges you. Therefore, it is important that appropriate quality standards are satisfied and there is a set of requirements to ensure ongoing competence of providers. So says the CMA, and I agree. At paragraph 5.98, the CMA refers to the SRA's research that found general familiarity and confidence in the term solicitor, and that solicitors were generally regarded as better qualified than other providers within the sector. I would comment only that solicitors are, in fact, well qualified, being awarded title after 6 years plus of academic study and practical training. Somebody last year from the Legal Services Board, those who choose to call themselves solicitors. They don't choose to call themselves solicitors. They earn the title of solicitor following hard study and hard work. So we are considering a market in which purchasers are often engaging at a time of personal vulnerability and are faced with the prospect of using different types of provider. A market where there are 9 regulators pursuing their objectives to promote competition, a regulatory objective, and where the different providers offer differing levels of protection, and indeed, some providers no protection at all in the event that something goes wrong. The house wasn't properly conveyed. The losses from the accidents are greater than first appeared to be the case. The business was transferred without proper investigation of liabilities. If they had used a solicitor, they would have recourse and would be compensated. The CMA calls for a greater transparency to protect the market. I'm grateful the CMA acknowledges the differences in protections offered by different providers. It notes that the majority of consumers were unaware of the regulatory status of their legal service provider, suggesting that most consumers are not making informed decisions about the level of consumer protection that they require when buying legal services. This can become an issue, particularly if they find that they do not have access to adequate redress. Vulnerable consumers find that after the event. This matters. I note and agree with the CMA that consumers' awareness of consumer protections is particularly relevant when comparing authorised and unauthorised providers. We, that's the CMA, would generally be less concerned about any differences in protection if consumers were aware of the differences in regulation between authorised and unauthorised providers and the different levels of protection that may be afforded to them and could therefore make informed choices. Therefore, the important work in this context, as it is with the broader access to justice strategy and campaign, is the need to attend to and promote public legal education so that people better understand their rights, responsibilities, remedies, and in some cases, sanctions. In simple terms, what are my rights and what can be achieved as a consumer? But beyond that, greater transparency of the different providers in the market and the protections they offer. There are regulatory objectives that go towards promoting public legal education as well as the promotion of the market. The Legal Choices website has been referred to. If you go to it, it is part of public legal education. It certainly doesn't come anywhere close, in my view, providing access to services. It acquaints you with some of the terminology. My concern is that promoting competition and in some instances reducing protection could and will expose vulnerable consumers to exploitation. The Law Society has established a toolkit to help our members to improve levels of transparency around pricing. Why not discriminatory pricing if you are a solicitor, if you have the capacity to undertake 150 cases a month, you have 130 on your books? What about selling those extra 20 at a reduced price? It all goes straight to the bottom line. But also to explain the value they bring. I was brought up on the adage, people know the price of everything, the value of nothing. The baby goes out with the bathwater. The consumer panel has expressed concerns over the effect of the SRA's proposals, suggesting that solicitors working in unregulated entities would advise, but without many of the protections afforded to clients receiving advice from solicitors in a regulated entity down the road. There is a clear opportunity for confusion and consumer detriment. They would be receiving advice from a solicitor who would not be bound by client conflict rules, would not be able to offer legal professional privilege in respect of clients' confidential information, would not provide access to the Ombudsman service to raise complaints, would not be obliged to carry and provide professional indemnity insurance, would not provide access to the compensation fund underwritten by the practitioner profession. In short, we support public legal education so that consumers can make informed choices. In the meantime, we do not support, and indeed we oppose, changes that undermine the standing of solicitors at home and abroad, and with it this jurisdiction, and risk confusion and detriment to the confusion, to the consumer. Neave spoke of competition in our liberalised market as against those operated by our continental colleagues. Frankly, speaking to our continental colleagues, they think we are madly competitive. There is a legitimate discussion to be had over the nature of regulation. moving from professional regulation to market regulation, to include, therefore, regulation of unregulated providers. What is the level playing field? What is the extent of recourse that should be offered to all consumers in the marketplace? And how does that differ from professional standards for those providers competing in that marketplace? There is also a discussion over the independence of the profession, the duties owed beyond the client to the administration of justice and the rule of law. I talk about the essence of the profession in the context of that duty and the criteria against which we judge the proposals and reforms that are made from time to time. But I've said enough. Thank you very much indeed. I look forward to engaging in discussion.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Paul Phillip. I'm the chief executive of something called the Solicitors Regulation Authority. It strikes me that not everybody in the room might know what that is. It's the Law Society, because actually I'm an officer of the Law Society. I'm employed by the Law Society, and therefore I'm accountable to the Law Society, and therefore in some ways I'm accountable to the gentleman sitting next to me on the left. That is wrong. It has to be wrong, because the interests of the profession are fundamentally different to the interests of consumers, and therefore actually the stated objective of the Law Society to promote, represent and support solicitors is actually at odds with acting genuinely in the public interest. Robert's heard me say that before, and I need to get that off my chest, so thank you very much. What is the SRA? The SRA is the regulator of solicitors' firms. And actually, we are the Law Society, but the Law Society put us offshore some time ago in order to make sure that when push comes to shove, the public interest does come before the profession's interest. And actually, that bolsters trust in the profession, which is good for solicitors and it's good for the public. So broadly speaking, we are the largest regulator of legal services in England and Wales. We represent something like 86% of all legal services providers, and of course, those are all solicitors. We basically do all the stuff that you would expect. We authorise people to practice law. We take people off when they do bad things. We run a compensation fund, as Robert has already alluded to. And we are an unusual mix of a professional regulator there to uphold high professional standards, but at the same time, as Robert has already said, have obligations under the Legal Services Act to look at issues like competition, the market working correctly, and access to justice. In an era where legal aid is dwindling, it has to be in the public interest that a market works correctly so that the operation of business costs is reduced, and therefore actually the opportunity to reduce the price of the service offered to consumers is maximised. But in order to make sure that businesses pass that on to consumers, you do need the operation of competition. So, actually, we welcome the SRA, the CMA's report. We think that it chimes a lot with what we've been doing the past few years, and I'd like to just take 2 or 3 minutes to talk about what it is the SRA's been doing. And actually, we've been doing quite a lot on the competition front. We've been looking at how the market operates, and our view is that actually the protections that have been mentioned by other speakers are gold-plating the market and leading to high costs, which are passed on to consumers. And actually, that has to be wrong. So we've looked at, we were legally obliged to introduce something called alternative business structures. Those are businesses run and owned not solely by solicitors. So actually these are businesses which was an attempt to introduce innovation into the market, but actually not as much innovation as one might have expected was introduced. There is something like about 500 alternative business structures in operation at the moment, and most of them look like traditional law firms where people have just brought their finance director onto the board and given them an equity share, or alternatively, it's a sole practitioner who's brought his wife onto the board, that type of thing. Nothing particularly dramatic. And you've got to look at why that was the case. The whole idea was you would have a one-stop shop where professionals could work together, where small business could actually go and get legal advice. Perhaps accountancy advice is the other obvious source of advice that a small business might need. But the thing that stopped it was the multidisciplinary practice rules, which were in the handbook of the Solicitors Regulation Authority, which were inherited from the Law Society. And actually, it took us, in my humble opinion, too long to change those rules, but we changed them about 2.5 years ago, allowing proper one-stop shops between professionals offering advice to small businesses and to consumers, particularly accountants and solicitors working together. That's a market opportunity for solicitors and a market opportunity for accountants. So far, the accountants seem to be the only people who are picking up the cudgel on that. And I personally think that's a missed opportunity. The next thing we had to do is we need to remove another rule that the Law Society has had in place for a number of decades called the separate business rule. This is a rule which actually stops solicitors owning other types of business for laudable reasons, it has to be said, but times have changed and there's a need for things to change. So basically, we abolished the separate business rule because given that we've allowed accountants to own legal businesses, it would be wrong if solicitors couldn't own accountancy business. So we abolished that, allowing genuine opportunities for solicitors to engage in market and allow professional services firms to flourish. And now, as Robert has already alluded to, we've just finished consultations which basically propose a proposition that at the moment a solicitor can only work within a firm which is authorised by us, and there are costs to that. And we are suggesting that actually allowing a solicitor to be embedded in other types of businesses would be a good thing. We think that if you went to a travel agent and actually bought a package holiday and that package holiday was cancelled at the last minute, that you shouldn't have to go onto the internet and actually get someone with a success fee to try and get your money back. You should basically have the travel agent with embedded legal services who can roll that up in the contract and they could act for you. That's a classic example of the type of thing that we think would be good for business and good for the solicitor's profession. That solicitor would be properly regulated, held accountable to a code of conduct in the same way as every other solicitor would. The issue that might cause problems here is that the types of things that a solicitor has in a regulated business, which add to the cost of that regulated business, probably wouldn't apply. So professional indemnity insurance wouldn't be there. Professional privilege probably wouldn't be there either. The Law Society suggested that leads to a two-tier profession. Our view is that it would give more access to properly trained and properly regulated solicitors for many, many more consumers in the marketplace. So it's a contentious proposition. We accept that. We've just finished a consultation. We'll see where we get to. But it would certainly give more access to professional solicitors and would provide more opportunities for solicitors to work as solicitors in the marketplace. And that's why we're promoting that particular idea. The next thing is education. In terms of where we've been with education, well, we stopped at the game of collecting points for CPD, and it was a game, and it was a cost, and it cost businesses money which were passed on to consumers. We then, for the first time in history, produced a competency statement for a practicing solicitor. And now we're looking at the idea of upholding professional standards for those who want to enter the profession, protecting the reputation of the profession by making sure that those who get into the profession pass the same examination, the same assessment, regardless of the route which you take, whether you take a Silex route, a traditional LLB, an alternative degree, and then a conversion course, or you go through an apprenticeship model. You will all have to sit exactly the same high standard of an examination. I can't see what's wrong with that. I think that's perfectly reasonable and is in the interest of the profession and the public. The next thing we've been doing is we're trying to look at the issue of proportionality. Bureaucracy and regulation have their place, but when overplayed, they lead to protectionism and actually to people looking after their own business interests and not in the interests of the public or consumers. And actually, a lot of the regulatory regime which the SRA inherited from Law Society was and remains to some extent completely gold-plated. It adds cost to running the business, costs which are passed on to consumers, and actually we intend to reduce that to a properly proportionate model. Does that reduce consumer rights? Of course it does. But consumer legislation in this country has grown quite considerably over the past few years, and actually consumers have lots of other rights. So Robert's right. If we were to go into the process of having solicitors operating outside of a SRA authorised firm, you wouldn't have access to the compensation fund. The key issue is you should know about that before you actually get the advice. You should know what you're paying for, and that service should be a more affordable service than those if you went to a properly authorised firm. So proportionality and bureaucracy have gone down. The costs of the organisation have also gone down. So actually, over the last 3 years, the cost of the SRA have gone down something in the order of nearly £20 million. And actually, that will continue to be the case. But actually, the thing that I think the CMA are getting at is the cost of running a legal business need to go down. So regulation is necessary and sometimes is very good, but when overdone, it leads to protectionism, it leads to high costs, and those are not often just passed straight on to consumers. So those are the types of things we've been looking at, and this year we will return to an old chestnut from our perspective, which is the cost of professional indemnity insurance and the idea that it is far too high and is passed directly on to clients and therefore making services more unaffordable for the average punter. 9 out of 10 people who actually need legal advice do not see a regulated solicitor or a regulated barrister. That can't be right. And therefore, we need to make more people be able to afford those professionals, and that means that they need to be able to provide the services at a lesser cost. It's not a universal panacea, but it is a help. Lastly, I'd like to say that the last thing we've been doing, and we're just out to consultation on a discussion document, Chimes was one of the themes of the CMA, which is the idea of open data. What should you as a member of the public be able to see in order to make an informed consumer choice about buying the services of a legal advisor, solicitor or otherwise? Well, the answer to that has to be as much information as you require or want. At the moment, there's very little information in relation to the price of those services or indeed the disciplinary record of anybody who you're using, whether or not they've got into trouble in the past, or the complaints record with the legal Services Ombudsman. And actually, we think, and we agree very much with the CMA here, that that's the type of thing that should be out there for people to use before they make buying decisions in relation to solicitors. And actually, that ultimately can only improve trust in solicitors, and we think it's a good thing, and we intend to push ahead with that type of agenda. So, to finish, on transparency, I would say that the SRA agrees nearly 100% with everything that the CMA has said on that. We are pushing ahead. We're providing data feeds for comparison websites for solicitors. And actually, I really do think that the time has come where consumers of lawyers should have the same types of choices they have for other sectors. I haven't mentioned the dreaded word independence because actually it's been an ongoing festering sore in the sector for some time. But the idea that actually we are the Law Society causes us significant operational problems. There's 10,000 people complain about solicitors every year. And on a week, on a daily basis, there's about 25 to 30 calls a week. So that's about 5 a day, we will have of people ringing up, and as soon as they find out, they'll say, "You are independent, aren't you?" We'll say, "Yes, we will act independently," and then they'll say, "Well, are you the Law Society?" And at that point in time, we have to say, "Yes, we are." And Robert's right, we are the independent, operationally independent armed Law Society, but it doesn't cut it if you've got a beef about a solicitor. The next thing is, well, how do I know that you're acting in my interest? Isn't it all an old boys' club? And actually, trust in solicitors is reduced considerably because of that. And we think, because of that, if nothing else, we should be independent from the Law Society. I've already mentioned reducing costs. I just wanted to say something about CMA's proposals on title and activity, risk-based activity modelling. We would agree with the fact that the present reserved activities properly don't reflect proper risk in the market. We would also agree that regulation by title does to some extent lead to it's a rather obtuse way of actually regulating. So if you were to regulate a licensed conveyancer, then actually it's a single activity-based regulation, and I can understand why that thinking has arisen. But the fact is that the standing of English law is where I probably do agree with Robert. We're in an interesting political time at the moment where actually, people are doing their best to attack the standing of English law throughout the world. English solicitors, English barristers are second to none. And I would just pause on the timing of that before I attacked regulation by title, or indeed I moved away from reserved activities. What I would say, however, is there's no doubt that the philosophy behind the idea that regulation should be attached to where the risk is greatest is absolutely correct. I just question whether or not now's the time to do it. Thank you.
Great. Well, we've had an incredibly rich array of comments there, and as you can see, there's automatically some things you can start picking up there. I just do want to remind you at the moment, before you ask questions, that the session is being recorded, so if you don't want to speak and be recorded, then don't ask any questions during the recorded period. I am going to bundle up questions and take them kind of two or three at a time. If you could keep your question as a question rather than your exploration of various aspects of interest to you. Just keep your question as a question and quite short. That just gives us time to get more people having the opportunity to ask. And if you can just give a brief indication of who you are and where you're from, that would be very helpful. So I'm going to go for three. We do have roving mics. I've got a flurry of hands. The gentleman at the back, he was very quick to put his hand up. Lady in the middle to go there. And then gentleman at the front, I think, was also. Then I've got another three over here to come in. So as I say, just keep your questions quite short. And if you do want to direct them to a particular member of the panel, please do so. But I think I'm going to allow panel members to chip in and pick up whichever particular questions are of most interest to them. Thank you.
Madam Chair, better declare my lack of credentials.
Sorry, could you put the mics like
this? Sorry, Paul Hudson, no longer a fixed academic abode, as they say in the crime reports. I better declare my lack of credentials. I'm probably the most ignorant person in the room because I don't have a legal background. Mm-hmm. There are two or three points that arose. When the president of the Law Society spoke, he reminded me of an old German saying. I know he's got to put forward the PR case for solicitors, that self-praise is no recommendation. And I've had a pretty bad experience, except one actually with solicitors. Just to summarise very, very briefly...
Okay, could we have it as a question?
Yes.
I just wanted to know... you're talking about competition from an economic point of view, and the second speaker actually referred to various concepts of competition. My background is in economics and statistics, as it so happens. The economist's notion of competition is that all the agents in the market, that's the suppliers and the buyers, actually have equal information. That's one of the first conditions. Now, as far as I can gather, there may be competition between the suppliers themselves, but as far as the clients, people like myself, who've had a pretty bad experience with solicitors, we just actually don't know even the questions that have got to be asked. Mm. So we're completely in the dark, and I don't think, although it may sound the fourth speaker spoke on the need for competition, I don't think this can be realised simply because... most clients, I would guess 99 out of 100, don't even know their basic rights. I remember reading Harry Street's book on, I think, Law for the Citizen about 60 years ago. I can't remember what it is. But I don't know what my basic rights are. I probably still don't know what my first three basic rights are in law. And I don't think I'm untypical of the general population. So I don't know how you overcome that. But competition doesn't seem to me likely to be realised, certainly from the client's point of view. Really, I'd like you to comment on that.
Excellent. Thank you very much indeed. So, lady in the middle, thank you.
Okay. Joan Lockery from the University of Leeds. I've got a couple of questions, actually. First of all, in the report, it's clear that trust in the legal services market, and indeed in any market, is the way to promote engagement with that market. So I just wondered whether there was any research into why consumers trust solicitors more, trust regulated titles more. Is it because they think they're providing better quality, and we won't go into whether they are or they aren't, or is it that they're, in addition, that they're trusted to behave in a professional way, and what does that mean? Which brings me on to my next question, and the point about solicitors working in unregulated entities. I do wonder whether, I'm a bit old-fashioned, I assume that there is a value to professional values, and I do wonder whether the SRA is a bit concerned about the pressure on professional values of solicitors working in these unregulated entities, and how they're going to safeguard about that. Have they carried out any research? I'll be very quick. I know there's research suggesting that ABSs are not a greater risk, but is that research nuanced? I mean, we know that most ABSs are in fact converted law firms. Is there research into the pressure on lawyers in ABSs where they're a minority, because that might be quite important.
Excellent. Thank you very much indeed. So this gentleman at front here. Thank you.
Hi, I'm from Scotland, and it's just more a question for the CMA and SRA. How realistic can you expect it for consumers to go and look at different liability structures for different legal services providers and actually educate themselves on this online? Why would you assume in those instances they would trust an online review more than the recommendations by their peers? Also, for the CMA's suggestion of a almost money supermarket for legal services, how worried are you about the race, a race to the bottom, almost sacrificing quality? For example, there are legal service solicitors firms in Scotland who offer you two meetings for conveyancing your house, and that's all you're going to get at the price that they've given you. So, how concerned are you about a race to the bottom?
Okay, thank you very much. So I think we'll I'll ask my panel members to answer in the order in which they spoke, which conveniently starts off with Rachel picking up the first question. Don't feel you have to answer all the questions, just pick the ones which are most relevant to you.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, I mean, I suppose the first point I wanted to make was in relation to the first question where you talked about the lack of knowledge for consumers. I mean, that's exactly the issue that we're trying to address with our recommendations. We believe that the legal services sector, compared to many other sectors, there's a very, very little information for consumers. Consumers are not able to purchase in a sort of intelligent fashion. So I think getting some sort of transparency of price and service and quality out there is incredibly important. We don't quite know, and actually this picks up a little bit on Niamh's point too, how consumers are going to engage. We need to see how that works over time, and there may well be more that we need to do to get consumers to engage properly, but there are some fundamentals to put in place first, and I think that's what we see as really important. I also buy the kind of legal education point. Public legal education is incredibly important. We've talked about improving legal choices. It's not a panacea, but it's a starting point. I think if we can make that available to people and they have better understanding of the options open to them. Coming on to the question about trust, some of that the question was, I think, about solicitors versus other people providing legal services. I mean, actually, of course, the truth is that most people turn to solicitors. Most people are not aware of the options that are available to them, and that is part of the issue. I'm less concerned about the race to the bottom, because I think people need to be aware they need to have the information so that they can choose a cheaper solution if that's what they're looking for, but they need to understand the risks that are associated with that, and so getting basically better information out there is fundamental.
Niamh?
What I have to say is probably the least interesting of everything on the panel here, but it's just the question of, you know, can competition fix information asymmetries, I think, and the problems that exist in the current market. I would say, I mean, I don't think it isn't a panacea. It's a very, the market structure is such that it isn't a normal market like it might be for buying pints of milk, but there's also a lot of evidence that a tightly regulated, uncompetitive market doesn't work in consumers' interests either, or doesn't work in legal users either. Is no guarantee of quality. If you've got a bad solicitor, the fact that they're acting in an uncompetitive market doesn't mean they're going to be necessarily a better solicitor. So if we can take some of the advantages of competition, I think that there's a lot of moving targets in this particular market.
I'm always disappointed to hear people who've had problems dealing with a solicitor. Clearly I am. I think that you've mentioned, you know, which questions would you ask, in what order, of whom, how do you get remedies? So the principle behind the solicitor's profession, and indeed similar to the growth of other professions, is that people should have confidence in the quality of knowledge and conduct, and they should have recourse to remedy. And that is provided a number of different ways. And accessing those, including complaints in relation to a failure against professional principles, would be directed towards the solicitor's regulation authority, having exhausted the complaints within the firm. And there are professional rules that deal with that. I think that Paul mentioned earlier consumer protection well established. Actually, all the issues we're presently dealing with within the civil regime of cost regimes, issue fees up by 600%, have all actually raised question marks over the ability of individuals to obtain remedies outside the sort of professional regime that we have in place at the moment. I absolutely share the concern of the lady from Leeds University in relation to the position that an individual solicitor bound by professional conduct rules but not supported by the rules operated within a regulated entity, the pressures that you could be placed under in your travel agent where you are the solicitor employed tamed to advise, where the entity is not to be controlled in relation to issues around conflict of interest, in relation to KPIs that generate revenue, that generate profit, and so on and so forth. I'm concerned for the individual concerned there, and I heard what was said in relation to we should reduce the cost of practice by coming back to the old chestnut of professional indemnity insurance. Insurance cost reflects loss and claims history. You will only reduce the cost of insurance if you reduce access to that recourse by those who have lost. So which part of the consumer market is to be denied recourse to the comfort of an insurance policy where they have suffered loss? That's the only way. Or alternatively, you increase the quality, so far as the providers are concerned. You reduce the claims. You reduce the losses. So I share the concern, both for the individual working in the unregulated entity and also for the consequences for the consumer of simply reducing cost by reducing the extent of the indemnity. I think the question you asked at the front goes back to underlining this market will improve in its competitive environment if the knowledge of the consumers also improves. And that is where the effort should be applied, because it goes across to the unmet need. If I know what my rights are, if I know what the remedy may be, I know as an individual whether I'm going to want to pursue a claim or I can find some other way of dealing with it. So the self-medication route, rather than assuming that everybody has to get advice from a professional in order to get a remedy. And I think that all points back to public legal education. People have a better understanding and then they know what they can expect from the advisor.
There's probably more that unites Robert and I than divides us on this. We agree with high professional standards. We agree that actually we're saddened by the fact that individuals have had a poor level of service from solicitors, and actually that's the reason why the SRA was set up, because actually the SRA is set up to deal fairly and firmly with solicitors who do things which bring the profession into disrepute. And actually, you should be competent and you should be honest and have integrity and all the things in the Legal Services Act, which essentially are professional principles or standards which solicitors had long before anyone thought of the Legal Services Act. So actually, we agree on all that. I think the issue is the market does lack competition, and you've got to get the balance right between appropriate competition, appropriate regulation and bureaucracy and consumer protection, and allowing the market to operate better than it's operating at the moment. And what I see the CMA is saying is actually the market could work better, and there are bits and pieces in here which stop the market working, and therefore actually we should explore those. So what I see is what I call myself like phase one of the CMA work, like transparency, more information, consumer comparison sites, all of that has to be a good thing. But it has to be balanced with making sure that high professional standards have been maintained, and actually where you're a solicitor, you must live up to those. So actually, there is probably more that Robert and I actually agree on. On the PII, actually, I do think that the minimum terms and conditions in the Solicitor's Handbook, gold plate PII, for instance, a single, if I'm an insurer and the solicitor lies to me and says, I'll only do this type of work, I won't do that type of work, and then I go and do that type of work, actually, I have to pay out to the client, despite the fact that the solicitor's just lied to me. You try that with your car insurance. And actually, do you think the insurers don't build it into the premium? Do you think that the premium paid by solicitors is not passed on to the client? Of course it is. So actually, PII is in need of reform. We've just done a three-year exercise with insurers, getting the claims data that Robert talked about, and we will bring forward proposals for reforms to the minimum terms and conditions and handbook later this year.
Another clutching question. No, sorry, so sorry. Thank you. I've got a gentleman here at the front, a gentleman on the side. Is there anybody on this side of the room? I feel we're unbalanced, spatially. Any others?
Not by
okay,
gender.
Lady in the front. Thank you.
So, Duncan McPherson, Lloyds Banking Group. Just wanted to quickly ask the Law Society and the SRA, how ready are you guys for disruptive technology firms entering the marketplace and potentially redefining the landscape altogether? And how will you ensure and what sort of protocol and what sort of legislation will you need to put in place to ensure it's a level playing field for your consumers, whether that's the major banks, whether that's consumers or other people in the marketplace?
Can I just ask specifically, what do you mean by disruptive technology?
So the likes of artificial intelligence providers or having like an Uber moment where Uber have just disrupted the taxi industry?
Hold that thought. I've just forgotten what I was going to say.
It'll come back.
Call Uber.
Andrew Smith, I'm a consumer, I guess. A two-part question. First part for Rachel. I'm just wondering if you looked at the profitability of law firms, and that bar graph of some of the prices suggests there are some rather super profits going on at the higher end of those bar graphs, and whether you looked at that. Second part is for Paul and Praneev. The CMA proposals on open data sound a bit wet to me. I just wondered if you believe that they will actually allow you to, or us as consumers, to see what's really going on. Because it all seems about, please, maybe, can you, you know, rather than actually, you must, you will, and if you don't, we'll sue you.
Thank you. Lady just at the front here, please, with the mic. Thank you.
Excuse me. So, given that access to legal representation is critical for the rule of law, this topic came up extremely briefly in the conversation. I was quite surprised. Is there not a case for this particular market, given its importance and its importance for democracy, for there to be state aid for the majority of those who would like to buy legal advice but who are no longer able to afford it?
Thank you. Okay, so legal aid question thrown in there at the end there. So we've got disruptive technology, we've got issues there in terms of the high end of the market and the open data being a bit wet, and then we've got the legal aid question. Paul, do you want to reprise your thought?
As I say, I instantly forgot it, having the memory of a goldfish. But
it'll come back round.
Well, actually, how ready are we? The answer is I'm not sure, but you do see an increasing internet-driven type of way of delivering business. So if LegalZoom is a classic example from the States, where you're actually seeing organisations which are providing stuff online, where actually it provides more consumer or small business redress than actually the average solicitor in this country, because actually it's cheaper. So it is over here. We have licensed it as an alternative business structure. We see no problem with that, but there are other types of technology that are being developed that we haven't really begun to think about yet. And actually, it's not regulation that's driving the market, it's entrepreneurs that are driving the market, and actually we all need to take it as it comes. I think it's a really good question. I don't have a really good answer to it. Can I just pick up the wet question, if I may? I'm not 100% sure what you meant at the end about sort of absolutes rather than please, please. But the fact is that we at the SRA have an ongoing discussion about, we're very much into reducing unnecessary bureaucracy. So we used to ask firms for lots and lots and lots of data, and we didn't do very much with it. And we've tried to stop asking them for data that we didn't do very much with. So it's one of the pieces of data we ask people is, what language do you speak? Actually, I'm not 100% sure what that's got to do with practicing law in England and Wales. But actually, I think the Law Society probably quite good from their perspective in terms of giving a marketing role for individual solicitors firms. But once we agree a data set, it has to be a you must provide this. You will provide it.
Otherwise, you're in breach of our regulatory arrangements and we will take action against you. It has to be that. Otherwise, there won't be the level playing field because some people will just comply and others won't, and that's just an unacceptable arrangement.
Okay, Robert.
Disruptive technology. We do an awful lot as the representative body in seeking out people who are engaged in promoting alternative ways of providing access to knowledge, and that's effectively it. And frankly, I think some of the cost of entry, and it was mentioned earlier, the cost of entry into practice is affected by that. We now, I think of my own firm, went through a big merger back in 2000 in order to be able to afford infrastructure investment in IT. Now, actually, the way we occupy offices, you can buy it as and when you want it on a week-by-week basis, Regis or whoever it is, you can commission and access IT kit in a different way, and of course all these databases, and that's what they are, and algorithms, so on and so forth, actually are available to practitioners, those practicing the law, as well as those putting themselves in place. So I think it's very interesting, it's moving very fast, who can tell where it's going to go, and the issues in terms of how the market, the dynamic of the market, but fantastically exciting. And I've encouraged practitioners who said this is being driven by, I say we are being served by, it's available to practitioners as well as, so don't back away from it. Profitability of law firms, nobody has approached that. I don't know whether you have carried out any assessment of that. A certain level of profit is required. Certainly, I think people would be surprised by the average or median earnings of solicitors in this country. I think it's in the order of £31,000 a year. So it's not fat cat money by anybody's means or territory. And of course, in a marketplace, and I told you that this was only a review of a part of the marketplace, there are people who run their businesses differently and as proprietors of a business can extract a substantially higher profit figure from that business as they do in other similar large businesses. From corner shops, you have one level of earning to the chief executive of Sainsbury's or other supermarkets. You have another level of earnings, and that reflects a dynamic market, and the profession is a dynamic market. Open data, WET, what we are concerned about. Yes, of course, transparency and guidance and supporting the public legal education. There is a fact, however, and Paul referred to complaints history. How is that populated? Where does that come from? If I am a solicitor providing advice to people in relation to matrimonial work, I recognise from my position, I've never done it, but there is a great capacity for transferred malice, I call it. You've given somebody a hard time on the other side of a transaction, and somebody makes a complaint about you on a website. What does that do to your, and depend how it's done? I heard earlier that there was a review going on in relation to comparison sites, and I think we're concerned where it can impact substantially on the reputation both of the individual practitioner and the profession as to where that's going, and we want to be certain about that. Access to justice, fantastic problem for us at the moment. And what I've asked, in fact, the Lord Chief Justice, and I'm seeing tomorrow afternoon, is that we have a strategy for all the changes that are coming through. And the back end of it, the government has been has increased the cost of issuing proceedings by something like 600% in the last 2 years. How does a market cope with that? How do I, as an individual who has been sacked unfairly, deal with a cost of £1,000 to get a hearing before a tribunal, whereas 3 years ago it cost me nothing and it was supposed to be a recourse, where the median compensation is about £4,500. Where is the justice in that? And we know, and see it in the employment tribunals, where the number of applications has dropped from about 170,000 a year to something like 35,000 a year. It impacts both on the behaviour of those who owe rights and responsibilities. It also, what does it do to somebody who has suffered an injustice in the workplace when they can't get recourse? They can't get recourse. And we did a lot of work before the pro bono work this week. We got in the citizens' advice, the legal advice centres. They say it is becoming harder to get remedy on behalf of people who've suffered loss, housing benefit, whatever it might be, because the people who owe the responsibility, owe the liability, know that the risk of a claim is substantially reduced on what it was. And that actually, when we talk about reducing the cost, we talk about the variation in the price points and so on and so forth. The reality is, going away from even public funding of representation, The reality is that the access to justice has been really fundamentally affected to the disadvantage of citizens in this country by this extraordinary increase in issue fees. And it is something that we tell the government they need to do something about. Forget, really, all. It's relatively parochial, actually, whether Paul is independent from me. Actually, you know, you can see the level of independence and what we're here. The independence, forget it, he has poured me water. I said it wasn't an instruction. It was, anyway, that level of independence, the independence from the executive, independence of practitioner from client interest, the duties we owe to the system, but also the obligation we have in the public interest, not the vested interest, the public interest, to make sure that people are reminded that this system is there in a diverse society. It's a fabulously diverse society, really powerfully diverse, but you've got to be for something, and for something more than just competition in a marketplace, actually, for the values that keep us together, and if they're going to keep us together, we must have equal access to remedy. And that's, of course, where we want to inform the marketplace so people can make informed decisions as to what their rights are and how they get a remedy for that. So that's where I stand on it.
Thank you. That's very powerful. Thank you. Niamh?
Very quickly, I mean, on the civil legal aid point, of course, there should be far greater levels of funding, but it's a good indication or a good illustration of the limits of markets. A well-functioning market in legal services is unlikely to persuade a majority or a Tory government with an absolute majority that the vulnerable matter in a way that gets expensive. I absolutely agree that there should be far greater provision, perhaps not for all 85% of the so-called unmet need, because I think some of it is less legitimate than others, but for those in vulnerable positions, of course.
Very quickly, just to comment on, you asked about the profitability work, so we didn't do extensive work on profitability. As you said, you rightly point out, the price dispersion graphs are quite interesting in showing sort of some of the high levels of fees, at least, that people, or the differential in the levels of fees that people can charge for similar things. I just wanted to pick up on the disruptive technology point too, because of course alternative business structures are there to allow different entrepreneurs to come into the system, hopefully will facilitate some of that sort of innovation that we're talking about, and that's really part of the story, I think.
Great. I'm afraid, looking at the time, actually, that we don't have time now for another round of questions, but I do think we have covered enormous ground here. And in fact, we could go on and on. You know, there is no shortage of issues that are rightly contentious. And I think they're rightly contentious because they're difficult issues and they really matter. Mm. This is an area where it really, really matters to get this right for very, very fundamental reasons, which go well beyond whether or not an economist likes the way the market operates, which is interesting but not vital from my perspective. So I would like to, before we take the opportunity to thank our panellists in the usual way, just to let you know of further events which are coming from the Law Department. So next Tuesday in the Old Theatre, we've got Will Hutton and Colin Mayer, who are presenting the Big Innovation Centre Policy Report, and the panel discussion will be The Purposeful Company, a Healthy Prescription for UK PLC? And then on the 6th of February, in Sheikh Zayed, it will be a panel discussion on whether limitations should be applied to criminal law in the event of state crimes. Okay, so that's another. And then in March, I won't bother to tell you where it is, you'll have forgotten by then anyway. Shami Chakrabarti, who is, she was the head of Liberty, she's now a member of the House of Lords, and she's Shadow Attorney General. And she'll be in conversation with Professor Nikki Lacey on the role of the Attorney General. So that will be in March. All of those details will be up on the Law Department website. Now I'd like to take the opportunity to thank our panel members for what has been an incredibly stimulating discussion. Thank you very much.